Hey, welcome to the new CNADHD podcast. I'm your host, Liz Lewis, and I don't want to produce another boring podcast.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you go in iTunes, there are like 100 podcasts now about ADHD. Seriously, do it. Look, you'll be shocked. And I don't want to do the same thing that everybody else is doing. The CNADHD podcast is your place to get the best information and hear from the best experts in the field of ADHD. I take all this information and I make it understandable, actionable, and hopefully a little fun. It does not suck.
Welcome to CNADHD. With me today is Samantha Cooper from Unconventional Minds Coaching. I first found Samantha on Instagram and I was totally intrigued by her philosophy and I wanted to have her on the show and she agreed to do it. She specializes in adults with ADHD who also have other comorbid conditions, autism spectrum disorders, depression, anxiety, OCD, PTSD, substance abuse, and she specializes in the LGBTQ community and intersectional identity issues. If you don't know what that is, don't feel bad. I didn't know either, but she explains it in this really interesting podcast. I learned so much. And I think you will too. So let me introduce you to Samantha Cooper.
Welcome, Samantha Cooper, to CNADHD. I think I stalked you on Instagram first. Is that correct?
It might be. I think I like to think that we mutually admired each other from afar on Instagram.
Well, I have a complicated relationship with Instagram.
Oh, who doesn't? I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Instagram is interesting. I feel obligated to Instagram, but at the same time, I resent Instagram.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
And I'm very picky about who I actually follow.
That's good. Like, I think that is a recommendation for how to take care of your mental health and also be able to use social media. So
yes. And I think that social media in general for ADHDers is a little bit convoluted. I don't know that we use it always in the same way that someone neurotypical might. So anyway, first of all, you are an ADHD coach. Mm-hmm. Are you an ADCA coach?
Yes, I've trained with ADCA very recently and started my own practice last year. Okay. My practice is called Unconventional Minds Coaching, and it took me a while to come up with the name, but I really revel in, you know, being a bit of a revel in being a rebel being unconventional and unorthodox in the way that I approach a lot of things in my life. And over the last few years, since I found out I had ADHD, I've really embraced that about myself. And a lot of the people that I really connect with are also that way. And coincidentally, often have ADHD. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I went with that name and went with the approach to my coaching business.
Well, I really like the name.
Thank you.
And I'm really glad that you went to ADCA, because one of my big pet peeves, this is just my thing, one of my big pet peeves is people that call themselves coaches that don't have any training.
I completely agree. Yeah, I am with you on that. And the number of people in the world who don't understand that coaching is its own thing. It is not advising. It's not consulting. Yeah. And it's not mentoring. It's a different thing. And you don't really know that and get it until you've been really properly trained for over a period of time.
I agree. I totally agree. What is your ADHD story? You said you were diagnosed semi-recently.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed about 3.5 years ago now. So I was in the middle of desperately trying to finish my second master's degree, which I wound up getting. But I was 2.5 months away from my exams and working like full on with my dissertation at that point. And I really felt like I needed to drop out or was just going to fail everything. I'd been seeing a psychiatrist for about 1.5 years prior to that, who I really trusted. he was recommended to me by a friend with ADHD. I started seeing him. He was like, actually, let's not assess you for ADHD right now. Let's get a couple of other things more stable for you. And then after that happens, we can assess you. By that point, I was almost all the way through the 2 years of my master's. He gave me a 40-page assessment that he wanted me to do at home because he didn't want to charge me his like full fee. And it sat on my desk for something like 4.5 months. And I didn't do it. And finally, my academic mentor, who I had through my university, was like, okay, I see you for an hour once a week. Let's sit down and do this. And she did it with me. And we got it done in 40 minutes. And I took it back to him. And based on everything else he knew about me and data he collected, he was like, yep, you've got ADHD. Definitely. So my story is a lot more complicated than that, but that's kind of my diagnosis story. And he is actually the first person, that psychiatrist is the first person who taught me that an ADHD coach is like a thing that actually exists. Because at the same time that he was like, okay, well, we could try medication, he said, you could also try seeing an ADHD coach. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I will take every possible like treatment that I can get right now because I want something to work. So yeah, it did both of those things.
That is rare. I feel like a psychiatrist who understands ADHD and understands the value of something like coaching. Because I feel like a lot of times, if I said, even here, I like my doctor, but even if I said it to him, something about ADHD coaching, he would just be like, oh, that's different than therapy, right?
I found in the States, so this is in the UK, but in the States, like so many psychiatrists and doctors have no idea that ADHD coaches even exist. So yeah, I didn't know at the time how rare that was. Now I do, but my suspicion, I have no really solid evidence for this. My suspicion is that he has ADHD himself, and that he decided to see an ADHD coach at one point. And the rest is history. And then I think that he probably refers a lot of his patients who have ADHD to ADHD coaches.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
That's really good. The only barrier I've ever found to coaching is usually cost, because the really good coaches with hundreds of hours of experience, which if I was going to drop money, I would want one of the ones, like the really good mm-hmm. ones. They tend to be really, really expensive. But that's the only barrier I can really think of for a lot of people.
Concern, and it's not covered by insurance. So a lot
right.
of people, which a lot of people don't realize for quite a while, that it's not something that insurance companies will cover in the U.S. No.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll ever get there. We have insurance issues, you know, in the U.S.
Yes. That is like a whole like podcast series in and of itself, really.
Well, healthcare and then mental health care. We just have issues in general with healthcare and mental health. I mean, we don't want to talk about mental health in this country. We still have issues talking about mental health.
Yeah.
Unless a celebrity wants to talk about it, then we're okay with it.
Yes. But otherwise it's taboo, really.
Absolutely. You finished your second master's. How did you end up deciding to become an ADHD coach?
So I saw my own ADHD coach. Actually, I still see him. I still see the same coach I started with 3.5 years ago. And I now have a mentor coach. After I finished that academic program, I had a lot of big shifts in my personal life. And I wound up moving back to the U.S. And that was kind of at the point where I was like, I love research. I love epidemiology. I love international development and economic development, which is what I did before. But I just like knowing more about myself and my ADHD diagnosis, I was like, I cannot sit in an office and do a 9-to-5 and churn out like high quality research in like that kind of environment. It's just, I guess I could try, and I'd make myself utterly miserable doing it. Like I had in other previous jobs. And I really have always found a lot of great one-to-one connections in previous work. And I thought, how can I sort of really build on my strengths of these one-to-one relationships and small groups and help other people, especially women who are diagnosed during adulthood, help them like figure out what now. So yeah, it came to me and I was very non-committal when I started with ADCA. I paid for like one course at it or one like module at a time for a bit. And then I was like, oh, okay, I guess this is what I'm doing. So I'll just pay for the rest of it. It's definitely been an interesting journey, but I feel like it definitely ticks the interest box and really like the human relationship box and like how coaching is so sort of relationship based. I mean, the relationship between the coach and the client that like I get a lot of joy out of that and building that rapport. I definitely feel like it's the right thing for me to be doing.
Yeah. I also enjoy the thing about coaching is, and I don't have one currently, mostly for money reasons. The thing about coaches that I always liked was that there are just certain things others can see and intuit about us that we cannot do for ourselves, the outside perspective.
Absolutely.
And someone to ask you the right questions. It's like everything. Yeah.
I also felt like coaching was really, really key in me really, truly going through the acceptance, the self-acceptance process that you have to go through after an ADHD diagnosis, at least as an adult. And figuring out like, okay, how is this affecting me? How has it affected me? Let's like look retrospectively at all of the things that have happened in my life and where did my ADHD come in? And it really came in pretty much every aspect. And having like a guide to that whole emotional and mental process was really key for me. And a guide who, you know, had the empathy and experience of also having ADHD themselves.
Yeah. And I understand that you know a lot about, it's a very popular buzzword right now, you know a lot about rejection-sensitive dysphoria.
Yes, it is a very popular buzzword right now. I don't know that I would posit myself as an expert, but I probably know more than the average person, perhaps even the average person with ADHD, so there's that. I also believe that I have it, and the emotional dysregulation and RSD aspects of ADHD have really come into play for me very strongly in my own personal story. And I see that a lot with women who have ADHD as well.
Yeah. And I noticed that in your, I guess it was one of your bios I read. I noticed that because I feel like that's always been one of my primary interest areas. And I'm not even a clinician, right? But I've always been interested in the inner life, the emotional life of women with ADHD. And so when I saw that, I was like, oh, I need to ask her about this. So, I mean, what is your, I know you said you're still working out on your website. What is your ideal, you know, client type? What are they seeking? What are they looking for?
A question that trips me up because I feel like I have to pick like one sort of profile and I don't want to. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. My like little ADHD rebel comes out, I think. But I would say that I connect really well with people who've been relatively recently diagnosed, or if not recently diagnosed, they're sort of now in a phase of kind of examining their life and how to move forward more with an ADHD lens. I am really, really happy to work with people of like any gender. The vast majority of my clients are cisgender women, and they're typically between 25 and 45, often at like transition points in their lives. And not necessarily like, oh, I'm like, the, not like a transition, like, oh, I decided I have to leave my husband and like move across the world kind of thing. But they're like, oh, okay, I've accomplished some of the things that I set out to do. Some of them I haven't, and I don't really understand why I don't Like, I don't know why I can't get my act together. Or I want to get my act together. I want to figure out how to do that, whatever that means. And a lot of it is also just like the emotional side of things, really figuring, like really processing through that stuff. A lot of it is figuring out how to treat ourselves better, because I feel like probably everyone in the world, almost everyone, struggles with how to speak to themselves like with more love and respect. But I've definitely found that to be particularly true of women with ADHD who were diagnosed or got received treatment late in life. We have tended to beat ourselves up a lot and treat ourselves very meanly, almost to like drill sergeant ourselves into getting stuff done. And at some point that you crumble under that. It doesn't work the way that you think it should. And it makes you feel much worse about yourself. And I think a lot of my clients, just by the very fact that they've reached out to me, have realized like, this isn't working. There's gotta be a different way. I don't know what it is, but I know I need support to figure that out.
Well, and I think women are very prone to trying to punish ourselves into submission. You know, like,
Absolutely.
If we constantly berate ourselves in our minds, then, you know, that'll produce the results we want, right? Yeah, and it doesn't ever. But for whatever reason, women seem to be very, very prone to that. So I am really, really interested to hear about, because I feel that this is an underserved population, some of the specific issues around transgender, non-binary, LGBTQ, polyamorous, on your presentation, and Samantha is speaking at the conference, and I know I'm being obnoxious about the conference, but that's just how I am. It says in the description that you're going to speak to this a little bit. So can we like get a teaser of that?
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of a teaser. So I have experienced myself in the transgender and non-binary communities. My personal anecdotal experience is that there is a really high incidence of ADHD and actually autism spectrum, ASD, in those communities and in those groups. There is also research, academic research out there that kind of supports that higher incidence rate, actually. That itself, so sorry, let me step back a bit. I am going to be talking about something called intersectionality. And I don't know if you're familiar with the term.
I think I Googled it when I first found your profile, but that was like, you know, a month ago.
Okay. Essentially, I am bringing in an intersectional lens as part of my conference session. Intersectionality, briefly, is essentially like a system or a process of examining like the intersections between different layers of identity and how those impact how we move throughout the world and how others see us and treat us. So the idea is that, I mean, intersectionality acknowledges, just as a very like basic example, a white, cisgender, heterosexual man who has ADHD probably has a very different experience of having the condition than a transgender woman of color or non-binary individual who has ADHD. Then there's also things like ethnicity and like the language, the primary language at home that someone learns, and, you know, their level of English, and even how medical providers treat them. So yeah, those are all things that will be coming up in my session. As for transgender and non-binary individuals, higher incidence of ADHD. And there's also, I've read a couple articles out there and talked to a few different people about essentially people who have ADHD tend to be more willing to think outside the box and outside the binaries and outside the things that we were assigned when we were born. And that we have this greater propensity for this than the general population. And therefore, it is not, it seems like completely logical to me that someone who has a propensity for outside the box thinking would feel more outside the box and be willing to live true to themselves in that way. And that gender identity and expression is part of that.
Well, I feel like that's something that we people could talk about. I feel like we could talk about that for hours probably, because there are so many identity issues all around with ADHD. Wow, my mind is just boggled, but it never entered my mind that there is any correlation between ADHD and neurodiversity. And when you said that, I just kept thinking, oh, like I had no frame of reference for that. So that is all new to me. And that's going to be a really amazing presentation, I think. I mean, because I don't think anyone's ever spoken about that topic, at least not that I'm aware of. I don't know.
It's one of the reasons why I decided on the session topic that I did, because I think that, don't get me wrong, I love ADHD community, and I went to the conference last year and I adored it. It felt really life-changing for me. But a lot of the topics that tend to be talked about in those spaces are things that have been talked about a lot. And there's nothing wrong with like going over them and like talking about them in different ways. But I was like, I think that I have some experience and knowledge with these other things that I can really, that I see huge intersection with ADHD and neurodiversity in general. And maybe it will shake things up a bit. And I think that I would appreciate seeing things shaken up a bit. And so decided maybe I could be part of that.
Well, you submitted it and you're doing it. So obviously somebody was like, yes, when they read it. Yeah. Well, I'm kind of excited. If I'm like, I'm working at the conference, so I don't know like what I actually have to do at different times of different days. That is yet to be determined. So, but if I'm around, I would just be really interested in listening to it. I'm just fascinated by the whole idea of it. The other thing, and this is a totally awkward transition, which is what I'm best at, awkward. one of the things I picked up on, and I feel like this was on your website, you really do, I don't know, a lot of work around creating healthy boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I feel like most of us with ADHD have boundary issues. Do you see that a lot in your clients?
Yes, absolutely. I see it a lot in my clients, and I see it a lot in myself and my other friends who have ADHD. And I think it often stems from, often we're people pleasers. And we kind of get our identity or have a tendency to get our sense of self and validation from pleasing other people. And it took me a really long time in life to realize that maybe that is not by default, like, the healthiest way to operate. So now I do a lot of work on that and how to just develop those boundaries in the first place and how to go through like the thought process and the emotional process to develop those boundaries, and then finding ways to implement them in a way that works for you based on your identity and the different contexts that you live in. But yes, it is a huge, huge issue for people with ADHD, especially women with ADHD, or people who are sort of not the stereotype of ADHD, which is, you know, the hyperactive boy. So non-binary and transgender individuals too. It's really important to talk about as well, because I think a lot of people a lot of us with ADHD are like, I'm at this point in my life, why haven't I gotten this, that, and the other thing done? I have so many things I want to do and I haven't been able to do them. What happened? And I do, among other things, I do think like having a poor sense of boundaries is a huge part of that, especially if we are people pleasers, because we can so easily be distracted and taken off our paths by this people pleasing tendency. And it's not just people pleasing, but of course it is also the social context in which we have to operate, and the expectations that are placed upon us based on our gender, our age, our race, our ethnicity, you know, how medical providers treat us, what language we speak, and that kind of thing.
Well, and girls, I mean, women and girls, we are socialized to be quiet. I mean, we don't want to take up too much space. We don't want to upset anybody. We don't want to say the wrong thing. And no becomes the hardest word. I mean, I don't think I, as a kid anyway, saying no would have been like an act of defiance, even if it was just a boundary thing. Like, no, I don't want to go over to that friend's house and play, you know? I don't know what that is. And I guess it could happen to boys too.
Absolutely.
But I just, it's interesting how many women, well, every woman that I talk to anyway, has some kind of boundary issue, and it shows up in different ways. You know, family stuff, stuff with your primary partner. Even in my parenting, I feel like boundaries are an issue sometimes, mm-hmm. because, well, that's really tough with kids. Like,
yeah, it's tough with kids in the first place, but you
feel yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. So like, how do you coach people around? Well, first of all, how do you figure out or zone in on where the boundaries are lacking?
A lot of it has to do with being aware of our emotions and also where we get our energy from and where we feel depleted. Where in our lives that we feel depleted. And I say that and I'm like, I feel like I make it sound really easy. It is honestly like the hardest thing in the world to begin to go through that process and really like tease those things apart. And if you're used to feeling totally exhausted and you are used to feeling like you are a good person because you don't ever like, you basically never said no to your boss or never said no to your partner or your child or whatever, or, you know, your other family members, your neighbor, then that's a really scary thing to do because it requires you to find different building blocks for your identity and your sense of self-worth. That's kind of where the process begins. When I'm coaching someone, it'll come up in conversation a lot, you know? It's not like they'll say, oh, they won't initially say, oh, I have poor boundaries with so-and-so, but they'll be like, oh, this person really likes me and I have a great relationship with them and they just really like me. Say you've got a boss who adores you or whatever. You know, there can be all different stories that go along with that, but sometimes it can be like, oh, I never say no to my boss. Like my boss always gets what they want from me. I go home exhausted, or I stay up until 2 a.m. without any like acknowledgement that I've done that. But they know they can always count on me. And so I feel like I'm more secure in my position and more secure at work because I never, like I don't say no. And I don't say, look, I need to get some rest, or I am not willing to do that right now, but I'll do it next week, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's really hard with certain people in your life, whether that's family or it is a boss or something like that. It's really hard to say no to somebody who is kind of in control of your livelihood. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And just to give a little plug for intersectionality again, this is exactly the kind of thing where I feel like it's really important, at least for coaches, to be aware of this intersectionality piece. And when I say coaches, I should say white coaches in particular. That's because, like, my experience in the coaching world is that there is not much acknowledgement that somebody who puts down a boundary in a certain way at work, if they are read or look a certain way or come off a certain way to other people, will be treated totally differently in putting down that boundary than somebody who looks a different way or is read by someone in a different way. And that, like, being really sensitive to that fact, I think, is incredibly important as a coach and in, like, really supporting our clients through this process.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can do your own coach training.
Yeah, maybe. Don't give me any ideas, please. I'll probably be like, yes, that's a great idea. I'm going to be all about it now and the 20 other projects I'm working on. But yeah, I mean, I think some more sort of, I don't know, training, but just, like, I want to see more discussion and more acknowledgement in the coaching community about these things.
Well, you know, things seem to be moving in a positive direction.
I agree.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's just, and nothing moves quickly. So I think it's one of those, you just have to put it out, and the more awareness, you know, we can generate around it. And unfortunately you have to do things like use social media, but, you know.
Yes. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have to post on Instagram.
And it's one of those things I have at least once a day. I think to myself, how could I communicate with the world, but not use social media?
People do that, you know, but it kind of blows me away.
How do you spread awareness? How do you spread a message? How do you, you know, and I feel like we're so bogged down in the social media most of the time, we can't think outside of it. I have a hard time. But, okay, so let's say that you're learning about boundaries, you're becoming a more healthy boundaried person, and you want to work on your communication. Another thing that most of us have issues with is communication. I mean, I know that I'm just not a fabulous communicator. I'm more in my head. You know, there's, like, a lot of stuff going on, but I'm not saying a lot of things. And then when I do say it, it's usually not the best way of saying it. And I don't know, like, what do you think are some first steps for people to better communicate their needs, maybe?
One of the most important pieces is kind of like this internal process. An acknowledgement that having boundaries is a kind thing for other people and ourselves. And it is not self-centered. Not that there's anything wrong with occasionally being self-centered, but I think especially being socialized as a woman, that we've often been taught that, like, having boundaries is a negative thing, and it negatively impacts other people, and it's not a nice thing to have or implement. Going through this process of, like, questioning that and the fact that we've been taught that, and is that really true, I think is a really important first step. And that is a huge piece of work that we will continue to be doing throughout our lives, I have to say. So that's not just, like, there's no, like, one destination there that people end up at. I think that's really important as you move forward into, like, figuring out how to externalize this to the outside world to get these needs met. And finding kind ways of framing what your needs are and the ways that other people can ensure that you are able to meet those. And I say that because it's really our job to get our needs met, and other people will not know what those needs are and what you require to actually meet them unless you state it clearly. Also, I guess it goes back to this, make sure that you put on your oxygen mask before helping others. If your needs are not being met because your boundaries are not well developed and communicated effectively, then you are not going to have the time or energy levels required to help other people. So that's, I guess, that also pertains to some sort of like internal process. I think that it can be particularly difficult for people with ADHD because to effectively communicate these, because many of us are verbal processors, as you probably figured out from me talking. And we think out loud, and we need to go through that process before we can even figure out what we really want to say. And I think having a way to engage in that process first, outside of the context in which you need to communicate those particular boundaries, is really key for a lot of verbal processors. Because then you, once you go through that process, you clarify your own thoughts and ways and like words that you want to choose that you feel are accurate. And then you can, for example, write them down and think about those more, and then go into the situation where you do actually need to effectively communicate those boundaries, and you have then the resources and have gone through the process that's necessary to be able to do that.
I'm just thinking of all the times like I've said something that was me thinking out loud and somebody totally didn't get that I was thinking out loud. Like, that has happened to me so many times, I cannot even count. And it's not even, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. Maybe it is a verbal processing thing. We say something out loud and it comes off, even if it's directed at nobody, you know, it comes off a certain way. Yes.
When really we're just sort of like trying things on and thinking, does this fit? If I say this out loud, therefore acknowledge it as my thought, does that actually sit right with me? Do I agree with that? Does that actually feel true? But in order to figure that out, we often have to hear ourselves say it. I think a lot of people in the world don't, like, there's not much acknowledgement that being a verbal processor means that we don't actually know what we really think or believe until we find a way to verbally process it. And therefore, like, most people are going to see us actually having that process, not in like really articulating the final product of that process.
Yeah. Well, you've given me so much to think about. Because I always need more things to contemplate. No, I'm kidding. No. Well, thank you for answering my questions. I know they were kind of random and all over the place, but that's how I roll.
I don't think we're random and all over the place.
Okay.
I definitely think that, you know, after having conversations like these, I'm like, oh, I wish I had answered that question so much, like, in such a more comprehensive way. Like, I feel like I only just, like, touched on a tiny corner of it. But I took all the time with my verbal processing. figuring out how to effectively communicate boundaries is, yeah, a huge thing. And that is exactly why I'm doing I'm actually going to be doing a whole course about it, because it's a big process and it takes a lot of sort of time to internalize it and a lot of practice.
Well, and before I start asking you questions about your course, I didn't even say this. I was thinking most of us are not exactly, when we're growing up, it's not modeled for us. Like, appropriate boundaries are not modeled for us. I mean, I don't know anyone who would say, yes, my parents had excellent boundaries with each other and with us. And yeah, like, nobody. So I think that's probably between the ADHD thing, the verbal processing thing, and, you know, we all have a set of conditioning and life experiences. I think that we just don't learn. We just don't learn about boundaries.
And I fully agree with you. It is very much an issue that, like, the general population has. I think those of us with ADHD can kind of experience it in a more magnified way, but everyone experiences that lack of cultural prioritization of boundaries. And yeah, I totally agree. I'm trying to think of like anyone who's ever like said, oh yeah, my parents modeled great boundaries for me.
Right. Right. So. Even like confrontation styles and stuff. It's not as if, you know, none of us learn healthy boundaries and healthy ways of arguing and fair fight. Like, we don't learn that. Okay. So tell me about the little, not, I don't want to say little, tell me about the course you're developing.
Sure. So it's healthy boundaries for ADHD. And yeah, it sounds a little bit like healthy ADHD now that I say that out loud. Yeah, so it's actually kind of based on my, to some extent, on my conference session topic. And it walks people through this process of figuring out what our boundaries actually are and then figuring out how to communicate those effectively to get the outcome that we want in any, or our goal in any given situation, while also acknowledging the contextual differences that we all experience in our lives, not just because we're all individuals, which reminds me of Monty Python, but also because of intersectionality, and we all have different sort of like places that we've been put in the societal structure in general, and we are treated differently by institutions and organizations. And so there's definitely an acknowledgement in that course of that fact, and that having, like, developing and communicating healthy boundaries is great for everyone. But also, like, knowing that somebody who experiences more discrimination at work, for example, from people's internal biases, that they may be in a position where they will need to communicate effectively about their boundaries in a different way with different sources of, like, different kinds of support than somebody who doesn't experience that level of discrimination and internal bias from other people at work, just as an example.
So will it be available by the time the conference starts, or?
Yes, it's going to be launched in October.
In October. Okay. Well, you'll have to, I don't know, again, that whole social media thing, you're going to have to be.
I will try to remember to update it on and promo it. Yes, I will. It'll be there. Don't worry.
Well, I don't have a huge email list, but let me know and I will send out, I don't know, some kind of little descriptor. Or if you have some copy, I'll send it out to the email list. I totally forget what I was going to say. Oh, yes. Where can people find you and learn more about your coaching?
Unconventionalmindscoaching.com is my website. My Instagram is unconventionalmindsADHD. I believe that my Facebook is exactly the same. So yeah, you can find out more about me on all of those sites. And I am very happy to answer any questions that people might have by email. And occasionally by phone or Zoom or anything like that. But email is probably the best way to reach me. I will be posting more about the course and my conference session as that copy is ready on my website, on my blog. So.
So people should come to the conference and hear Samantha speak. Yeah, people should come to the conference, hear Samantha speak, hang out with us. It's going to be fun. That's my little plug. I'm not that good at it, but that's my little plug.
Honestly, the conference was totally life-changing for me last year. Being in a place where there are hundreds of other people with ADHD, including all of my sort of ADHD heroes, was just amazing. And seeing that, like, seeing all the other people around who, like, accidentally kick over their coffee or, like, forget what they're saying in the middle of saying it when they're like the conference speaker. Yeah, it's just, it's amazing. It was a really big part of my like self-acceptance, but also just being like, I love being around these people. I love having ADHD. That was one of those moments for me.
Yeah. Most days you're like, I don't know. But yeah, when you're there, it is different. It's a whole different vibe. Yeah,
it absolutely is. And it's sort of energized me throughout the rest of the year, I have to say.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Samantha.
Thank you, Liz. This has been a lot of fun. And now I'm going to go like obsessively listen to all of the other podcasts that you have published.
Oh my gosh, this recording with Samantha gave me so much to think about. My brain was buzzing for about 6 hours after we recorded this. I mean, we talked about intersectionality and boundaries and verbal processing. I didn't even realize that I was a verbal processor until this conversation. Crazy town. So show up at the conference. It's going to be so fun. Samantha's speaking. I'm hanging out. Come and join the enclave. I love conversation. I love connecting with people. You don't necessarily have to go hire a coach. Just learn from each other. You don't need me one-on-one. I just create the space. Have a fabulous day. And remember, we are stronger together.